Midway across the Hudson River was a perfectly circular hit. UFOs over you,
and I ain't too surprised. Well, the thing is hovering sort of 100 yards away. I could have hit it with a brick if I'd gone.
For the first time in our history, we're studying something that's studying us.
Nobody told me that we'd like this.
Suddenly, something else flew into the frame. Fired a beam of light that struck the dummy warhead. Doing a circle, if you can imagine, circling our warhead. Fired another beam of light at it, which struck the warhead.
The Virtually Strange Network presents Strange Days Indeed, your premier source for UFO information, with your host, Errol Bruce Knapp.
Yes, these are strange days indeed, and this program reflects the UFO side of the strangeness. Welcome to program number 380 in the current series. Well, that's a lot of weeks, isn't it? Tonight, Dave Frelott and Stephen G. Bassett will join us. Dave Frelott, a weekly editorial contributor, and Stephen G. Bassett, a monthly contributor to this program. Good to know that Montreal is along for the 2 hours tonight. Happy to have you here. Alfred Lemberg, unfortunately, has the flu, and he won't be able to join us. I know he's listening. Get better soon, Alfred. Some warm... North of the border vibes. Yeah, right. It's like, what is it, minus 12 or 10 degrees Fred or at the moment. So it's pretty chilly here, but warmth to Alfred Lemberg, and let's help him get over his flu. In studio tonight, Victor Vigiani. Good evening, Victor.
Good evening, Errol, and everyone else out there. Alfred, get better and do it all. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Up on your feet again. So yeah. Join us again.
Yeah, we're going to miss your foghorn sound tonight.
We won't make any noises. We'll just talk. Oh, there you go.
That doesn't sound like his foghorn at all.
Listen, last week you were flummoxed.
Oh, yes.
And you were making requests for some CGI scripting assistance.
Yeah.
What happened with that?
Well, to explain for people who weren't with us last week, I made the big move with the Virtually Strange websites from a place where I had been really not too keen to move from because of the archive, because there's, you know, 60,000 messages there, and who knows what happens when you bulk move something. And sure enough, website says, you know, 63,000 something or other posts on the UFO updates list since 1996. Well, once we made the move, 96, 97, and 98 weren't showing up, and I agonized over it for a week. So finally, Matthew Didier said to me, well, why don't you ask for someone, you know, for some help on the radio?
Right.
And I did, and sure enough, Sunday I got an email from a very nice, very kind man named Derek here in Toronto.
Terrific.
And within a few hours, it was figured, and the archive is intact and online again.
Tremendous network.
Eh? Oh, yeah. It's good. And it's good to know that Derek doesn't always listen, but he has listened on a fairly regular basis. And last Saturday night in the second hour, he happened to be listening.
How fortuitous.
Yeah.
So it's all kind of fixed up now?
Well, almost. Yeah, there's 1 month in 2002 that just at some point just got totally messed up, and I have to rebuild it. But, I'm working on that as well as other things.
Yes, I can tell.
Yeah.
I can attest
to
that.
So, Derek, again, thank you, sir, and thank goodness that you're out there and listening. Some interesting stuff on the UFO updates list this week, don't you think?
Actually, I read two or three that just captivated me in a way of information. And I guess, you know, you and I were talking how good it is to see good, solid information coming forward. And the one that struck me, actually the two of them, was the one from Robert Hastings. In his, I guess, talking about UFOs and nuclear installations and the kinds of things that have been going
on. Nuclear weapon installations.
That's correct,
yeah.
And the things that have been going on since the, you know, late 40s and all the way through until now regarding UFO sightings, and his over 50 witnesses that he's spoken to, and he's got the testimony all written out, and I've yet to go through all of the testimony. I read the preamble to it, and fascinating information, I guess, you know, it brings about the whole kind of human nature of what this is all about.
And did I put that in the program links tonight? I don't remember.
I don't think it's there.
It's
I don't think it's there.
But bad.
We should have people.
Me very bad. UFO updates. If you go to virtuallystrange.net and click on the UFO updates link, it'll take you to the front page of UFO updates, and then go to today's February the 18th, and click the Feb 18th there, and you'll see a whole bunch of posts, and UFOs and nukes is the subject line. And in fact, the Norm suggested that maybe I should get in touch with Bob Hastings and see if he wants to do the program, perhaps even next week. So we'll take a run at that one.
Terrific idea.
It's a fascinating topic, and many of you will know that over the years of Strange Days Indeed, we have talked about UFOs over nuclear power plants and Minuteman missile bases in Malmstrom specifically with Robert Salas and Missing Times author, blanked on the radio. I can never remember his name, and it's a terrible thing to do, but there's a wonderful book called The Missing Times, and it's all the news that's not fit to print in the New York Times. And one of the major chapters in that book is the story of UFOs over nuclear missile bases, launch sites. And here's Robert Hastings, has been working quietly away in the background for the last few years and has gathered all of this conclusive. And it's all anecdotal, of course, but, you know, when you get from non-coms all the way up to colonels talking about UFOs shutting down the missiles in their silos.
And I don't know why he apologizes for it being all anecdotal.
Yeah.
I mean, how else can it all come out?
Well, you know, exactly. It's very hard to track down under the Freedom of Information Act in the States any more than has been released already. They say, the Air Force says, or whoever's looking after that paperwork now, that they've released all the paperwork that there is on UFOs. And
all six pages.
All six pages, yeah. And there are many, many, if not hundreds of missiles that had been shut down. Batteries died.
Sure.
Circuits didn't work as they suddenly leapt into the launch sequence and the countdown and freaked everybody out in the control rooms there. Whew, scary stuff. And a lot of these Air Force personnel were just totally freaked out when this happened.
Yeah, but some other group of people or some other entity has the capacity to shut down nuclear launch facilities is an amazing feat. Amazing feat.
Yes. It's, as we said, it's pretty damn scary.
Here with his take on it is Dave Furlong.
There's a post on the UFO updates list that caught my attention entitled, What's the UFO Danger Level? But instead of the post being a long treatise answering the question from one of the list members, it was simply a question being posed. Greg Boone was the author of the post, and he posed the question because he met a couple of people who had listened to a radio show about UFOs, and they were visibly shaken up by what they had heard. And they asked him what the threat level was. It's a very valid question in reality, because if we accept the main premise that UFOs are being piloted by beings from another planet, dimension, or time, then obviously there is a much higher level of technology. If we also accept that abductions of our people and mutilations of our animals are taking place and are a result of UFOs and their occupants, it becomes very easy for us to state that the danger level of UFOs is obviously very high. But is it? Most UFO researchers have been studying the UFO phenomenon now for over 50 years. And in all that time, there has not been any kind of mass invasion of the planet. We haven't seen anything remotely similar to the science fiction movies like War of the Worlds or Independence Day. We haven't seen ourselves enslaved or used as some kind of food source. The aliens or whatever have not tried to suck up all the water or energy or any other kind of natural resource we have on the planet. So in all this time, with all of their vastly superior technology, they haven't attacked us. So obviously, the threat from UFOs appears to be minimal, right? I'd have to say wrong, because there's a warning to people that goes, those who do not study history are doomed to repeat it. There's a name that you might not be as familiar with as Christopher Columbus or Hernando or Fernand Cortez. The name is Thorfinn Karlsefni. Thorfinn was the leader of a group of Vikings that created a settlement in Newfoundland, then called Vinland, by the Vikings in the year 1010 A.D., some 482 years before Columbus ever set sight on the New World, let alone before Cortez and his conquistadors showed up in 1506 to conquer Mexico in the name of Spain. But what does this have to do with UFOs and whether there's a danger? Simple. A mere 50-some years have passed since we have been taking serious note of the appearance of lights and objects in our skies. Not even a tick in the clock of history. The original inhabitants of the Americas had almost 500 years to wait before the threat to their world became real. They destroyed the initial colonization attempt by the Vikings and lived their lives without incident for some 15 generations, perhaps even forgetting about the threat from across the Great Water. But eventually, the threat reemerged. And this time, the technology that the invading forces brought back with them was even greater and more advanced than that the Vikings had brought with them. But even that Viking technology did not penetrate into the hands of the inhabitants of the Americas. They didn't greet the invaders with iron and steel weapons like the Vikings had. They used sharpened stones, as they had for hundreds of years, and tens of thousands of warriors fell as they went up against hundreds that used superior weaponry. It is possible that the governing forces of the Americas at the time decided that the threat to them was negligible because they managed to destroy the Viking settlement, but they ignored one thing. Where had the Vikings come from? Much like today, many people have accepted the findings of Project Blue Book. Project Blue Book concludes that UFOs pose no danger to national security. The UFO danger level is minimal at the moment, merely because we are living in a golden age of time between the first visit and that of the eventual emergence of a Cortez. I don't know when. I don't have a crystal ball, but I do predict that sooner or later, an alien version of Fernand Cortez will come forth, and we had best be prepared for the worst. But that's just my take on it.
Dave Furlong, every week at this time. Strange days, indeed.
My God, but you're cheerful tonight, Dave Furlong.
What can I say?
Yes. Yeah, that's yeah. What a lot of people in this field say. I'm really anxious to know what the answer is, but I have the feeling I may not like it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it's going to be one of those situations, and basically it boils down to the simple question of they didn't bother to find out where the Vikings came from. We have the opportunity. Let's find out where these guys are coming from.
Yeah, yeah. I'd like to find out where I'm coming from. Hey, Dave, thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Dave Frelott got a new book coming out very shortly. And, uh-oh, here comes that cold cough again. So let me quickly say goodnight, Dave. We head somewhere south of the border because political activist, lobbyist, and commentator working to bring about formal disclosure of the extraterrestrial presence, Stephen G. Bassett, is roaming the countryside down there somewhere. Evening, Stephen.
Evening, girl. Victor, good to be with you again.
It's good to have you with us. Are you still in California, or have you moved elsewhere?
Still in California.
Ah, nice. Very nice.
Oh, and... yes. Wisdom, my man, wisdom.
Yes.
You know, all these earthquake stories you hear, in fact, there really are no earthquakes in California. That was all created years ago because they figured that if they didn't convince the rest of the nation that we had all these earthquakes, the entire East Coast would move here.
Yeah, well, it's like tsunamis in Hawaii.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
It's just another day in paradise for Bassett. I know.
Yeah, 68, 70, no. Relatively clear skies.
Yeah, well, we've
Washington's
got...
2.5 feet of snow.
Yeah, well, we've got 10 degrees here in your language, minus 12 for us.
But Canada's different. You see, Canada, everybody knows that Canada is very north and cold, and it's kind of a cold climate, and you go there, you live there, and that's the deal. The East Coast gives you the potential for good weather, and then snatches it away from you.
Well, yeah, and we have the potential for really awful weather, and it's been snatched away from us several times this winter.
Yeah, although, global warming. I mean, you guys will be pretty much Californian about 10
years. Yeah, we'll be in the, I figure, high, you know, western desert.
Yeah, no snow,
here.
No glaciers, all gone.
Yeah.
I mean, it'll be kind of a semi-tropical tourist attraction. 10-15 years, just wait it out.
Yeah, and most of Europe will be under ice.
Yeah, pretty much.
Yes, well,
which
that
is a good place for it, as far as I can tell.
And we won't have any natural ice rinks outside anymore for kids to play on.
Well, that covers the UFO topic nicely tonight. Good night, Steve. Thank you.
That's it. Very good night to be with you.
So what have you been into recently?
Well, I've been planning all my various campaigns for 2006 and looking forward to what will be a truly stimulating year, I'm sure, on so many levels. And looking for funding, of course, always looking for funding.
Mm-hmm.
And monitoring the situation and building up new sets of metaphors. See, I'm big on metaphors, Earl. I think you know.
No.
Yeah. Metaphors and homilies. They are the intellectual bread of life. And the way I see it, they work for Jesus. You know. Go with a good thing. You know what I'm saying?
I was making signs of the cross at Victor as you said that. I want you to know that.
It's true. I mean, everybody knows this. And I want to use a metaphor this evening, which I think you will enjoy.
Mm-hmm.
There was a movie a few years ago which did very well. It's a good movie. It won some awards. Martin Scorsese directed. It was called The Gangs of New York.
Mm-hmm.
And I imagine that you've heard of it. Might have even seen it.
Mm-hmm.
If you actually read into the history of the Gangs of New York, which were these groups that formed out of the immigrant populations in New York back before the turn of the century, last century. It turns out, interestingly enough, that they were mostly formed, these gangs formed around volunteer fire departments. And it was like a logic, it was a convenient way for them to have a base of operation.
Mm-hmm.
And so, in addition to whatever else they were doing, they would go put out the fires. And frequently, and while they were volunteer, if you put out a fire, there were benefits that could come from that. Sometimes you get paid. Sometimes you get favors from Tammany Hall, whatever. So they would race like crazy to get to these fires, and frequently several groups would arrive at the same time. And it was not uncommon at all for these volunteer fire departments, which were made up of center of these gangs, to get into brawls and just beat the crap out of each other while the house that they were burned down. This happened frequently.
Yeah.
So 100 years go by, more than 100 years go by, and 2 days ago, in the news here in the United States, turns out, I forget the city, North Carolina, Ohio, I think it was Ohio, whatever, a volunteer fire department turns up at a house fire, and another fire group, I think maybe one of the regular fire groups, turns up at about the same time. And they get into a brawl over fighting this fire. And it was so bad, some of it got caught on tape, which is why it became a news story down here. And it was so bad that the brawl continued inside the house. And the two groups of firefighters are in there brawling with each other inside the house, ripping off each other's equipment to the point that some of them came down with first and second degree burns because they had that protection, turning off their air hoses, and the house burned down. So this caught my attention. It amused me that after 100 years, we're pretty much where we were in 1882. So... I started thinking about this, and stop me if I'm wrong, but I think I got a hell of a metaphor here. It's real simple. If you look at the world today, if you look at the circumstances that are going on, that we're all following with great interest because we're concerned about our welfare and we're stocking up, you know, food in the basement and water and all this stuff, buying guns. Essentially what you got is you've got a whole lot of male-dominated enterprises all over the globe in which the men that are running things are in a continuous brawling state, whether you're talking about Arab extremists, Zionist extremists, neocons, whether you're talking about the leaders of third world countries that are involved in several dozen wars that are going on right now, whether you're talking about Chechens, whether you're talking about Russians, whether you're talking about criminal crime organizations such as the major drug cartels, and on and on and on. Basically, there is a continuous state of brawling going on while the house burns down. Now, what's interesting about this, in the case of the gangs in New York and in this incident of a couple days ago, the house that burned down wasn't the house that belonged to the firemen. But in the case we're talking about, in the metaphor, in fact, it is the firemen's own house that's burning down as this brawling just goes on and on and on.
So are you going to tie this back into ufology and ufologists?
I
had a feeling you might do that. Yeah.
I dare me. Dare me to do that.
I dare you to do that, Steve.
Well, there's another theatrical device which turns up in movies all the time. You've seen it dozens of times if you watch movies. And it always involves a brawl going on somewhere, typically in a bar, right, some sort of barroom brawl, Western. They do this in Westerns a lot, right? Everybody is beating each other over the head. They're smashing chairs on each other, throwing bottles at the windows. You know what I'm talking about? Sometimes these brawls will be outside, too, right?
Spill out onto the street.
It's out on the street, exactly. Mm-hmm. And then but at some point, right, somebody has had enough of this. You know, the sheriff, the marshal, the townspeople, whatever, and this thing is going. And so finally, somebody says, this has got to stop. And so they usually stand up on a chair or something and they shoot off a gun, a rifle, a gun, and then miraculously everybody stops.
Yeah.
Right. They've gotten it, they had to get their attention, so they shoot off a gun. And everybody stops. And then they point out to them why they need to stop this nonsense, because they got to head off and get the bad guys, or the town's on fire, or whatever, right? This is very much the way I look at disclosure. This is exactly the way I look at disclosure.
Hmm.
I happen to, you know, I read a lot of stuff, and I follow a lot of media, not only alternative media, which is getting more interesting and rich all the time.
Yes.
But also the mainstream media, which is getting more ridiculous and absurd all the time, but yet still has some value. And overall, I'm scared. I won't use that word. I will use a lesser term. I am scared out of my pajamas. All right. We are really headed over the falls here. We're headed towards a nuclear war. We're headed towards a biological war. We're headed toward major financial meltdowns, environmental destruction. We have really hit the wall, finally, after a good run, you know, a good 10,000 years of really fine quality civilization. We're just about to hit the wall, or basically hit the windshield, to use another metaphor, which I think also works, windshield of reality. And if we don't do something pretty soon, we're gonna be really uncomfortable. You and I were born in some pretty good areas. And we've lived most our entire life either in the United States or Canada, and it just turns out these are sort of islands of semi-stability. The fact is that the whole time that you and I have been alive, there has been chaos out there, and what's really happening is the chaos is finally creeping up on our shores. It's getting closer and closer, so we're going to get drawn into it. But a lot of the world, it's nothing new to them, right? It's just going to be new to us. But overall, when it gets to the first world and starts taking down structures and institutions in the first world, these are some of the key driving engines that keep things together. And when they fall apart, it's all over. And so what are you going to do, right? Candlelight vigils, write some essays, form a couple of groups, think good thoughts, meditate. What are you going to do to stop a situation where you've got brawling going worldwide on the part of tens and tens of millions of people, getting worse and worse and worse? It spilled out into the street, it spilled into the church, it spilled into the schools, it spilled everywhere. What are you going to do? Are you going to shoot off a gun and everybody's going to suddenly stop? No. It's going to take something a lot bigger than that. Disclosure is that theatrical device that is so loud and so significant that when it goes off, it will be big enough to everybody to suddenly stop what they're doing and turn their attention to it. And whoever's standing up there at the time is going to say, okay, enough of this nonsense, right? We have bigger issues to deal with here. Mm-hmm. And they're all going to sort of, you know, nod their head, and then we'll have this sort of window of opportunity to address the issues or to put the fire out, right? So the house doesn't burn down. This is perfect metaphor as far as I'm concerned. And those that want to think about disclosure and why it needs to happen, that's the metaphor that I'm going to be repeating. And we don't have a lot of time left, right? The house will burn down in a certain amount of time, as in real life, and that's the case here. We have X amount of time. We either get these people's attention, divert it to something else, rethink what we're doing, and change our behavior, or it's over, right? And what I mean by over, I mean over. I mean like you and I are going to have a difficult old age, Harold.
Yeah.
I mean, talking, you know, forget, you know that thing about the nursing home that you can, you know, that your relative, your kids are barely paying for, and, you know, they give you a couple of meals a day.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to seem like paradise. You're going to wish you could, you know, live your last days in a nursing home. We have a limited amount of time, and this is a complex and difficult problem because unlike other kinds of things that you might suddenly push out there as a way to divert people's attention, this particular issue has been sequestered, it has been hidden, it has been embargoed, it has been manipulated, and so it's as rabbits go, this is a very difficult one to pull out of the hat, but we have to do it. We have to do it. There is just no other choice. I read the news media, I read the blogs, I read the magazines, I read the high end and the low end in the middle, and the message across the board is the jig is up, all right? The jig is up. You have high-end people talking about when the United States is going to have a nuclear event, when Washington's going to be blown up. You're talking about which country will launch the next nuclear devices. Will it be Iran? Not likely, but they're our focus right now because it serves the neocons' nutty agenda. More likely, it could be Korea. Could easily be China. They have hundreds of nuclear weapons still targeted on us. The Russians claimed that they detargeted the missiles in 91. China didn't say that. Our strategy with China has been we'll owe them so much money, we'll get so deeply into debt that they would never dare blow us up because then they'd be killing their debtor and wouldn't get their money back. I don't think this is a good plan. It's not a good plan.
Well, Stephen, I've always used the metaphor of the giant slap in the face. Being in education, I've quite often run into children who've been out of control, and sometimes you need to deliver a little cuff on the head or something. But that giant slap in the face, you liken it to a gunshot that wakes people up. I'd like to get into eventually where that gunshot's going to come from, where that slap in the face is going to come from, who's going to deliver it. Will it be a united effort? Will it be a single voice? Will it be the voice in the wilderness, or will it be a commercial on TV?
And will the human race say afterwards, thanks, I needed that?
Yeah.
Yeah. You're on a cell phone, right, Steve?
No, I'm on a hard line.
Oh, you're on a hard line. So, in fact, we can spend a little more time together and the battery won't run out.
Oh,
absolutely.
Good, good. Let's do something.
There's, we have plenty of time, Earl. We have all the time in the world. Let's talk some more.
Yeah. Duck and cover, Steve. Duck and cover.
Looking for asbestos suit.
It's as best as I can do. We have about 10 minutes, Stephen, so just to let you know that. Okay, so we're waiting for the big wow that is going to draw everybody's attention. The gunshot in the air, the slap upside down the head with an 8 before or 4 by 7 or whatever it is, yes?
Yes, and Victor had a point or question he wanted to make about that.
Well, it's more of a comment than a question, Stephen, is that in the very serious note to all of this, and there is a very serious side to all of this, is that we do as a planetary group of beings need to have our heads turned in another direction, because we have them, you know, constantly fixed on the ground. We dig into the ground, we destroy the planet, we do this, that, and the other thing. When with the number of things that are distracting us from looking beyond our own noses, when do you think that something will happen, not necessarily a UFO event necessarily, but something planetary, something political, something whatever, that will deliver us from this contemplating our navel to the point that we disregard everything else that's going on beyond the atmosphere?
Well, this is the point. Clearly, a wide-open contact event would have the effect of people dropping everything and redirecting their attention.
Mm-hmm.
But we can't count on it. And I refuse to count on it, right? I refuse to count on ETs doing anything. And that includes disarming our missiles when we launch a nuclear war, they'll just disarm those puppies. And they'll fall harmlessly in the sea. I'm not counting on any of that. As far as I'm concerned, this event has got to come from within, from a terrestrial reality.
Yeah.
I've been at this 10 years, and I'm thinking it could always happen tomorrow, but there's always some reason why, no, it can't happen. And the other point I'd like to make is that it's interesting, you know, we are trapped in our paradigms, and the old paradigm, you use these kind of metaphors like shooting off a gun and slapping in the face. In the paradigm that we need to get to, where I hope we're going, we wouldn't use that metaphor. I don't want to shoot off a gun. We already have enough of that going on. I don't want to slap anybody in the face. But want to get their attention, right? We want to get their attention so that they will stop what they're doing, which is essentially destroying the planet and building up towards endless conflict, endless wars. One of the great problems that we have is that we sort of live in a stream, a historical stream. And there's an old saying that the generals are always fighting the last war. It's also true that the activists are always protesting the current war. And very little and not enough is being done about stopping the next war. I've had some pressure put on me to, Steve, you know, this ET thing is all fine and dandy, but, you know, you need to start up a blog and you need to be pounding away at the administration and pounding away about the Iraq war and all this other stuff. And my answer is, well, you know, I could do that, but the fact is, when this war is over, there'll be another one. And after that one, there'll be another one after that. We've been at continuous war amongst ourselves for 10,000 years. What's happened is that we finally reached a point where it's finally totally self-destructing. As we all know this, 100 years ago, when the Gangs of New York firefighter teams were brawling with each other in the streets of New York while the houses burned down, the population of the planet was about 1.5 billion. Well, it's over 100 years later, the population is 6 billion, headed to 9 billion in about 30 years, maybe more. So it's time's up, right? You can continue to do what you're doing, but you're going to pay. You're going to pay big time in ways you can't even imagine. So it's over. So what do? You've got to get people's attention. What's the best way? It's disclosure. How do you get it? Every way you can, in any way that you can. And there's a lot of things going on, as you know.
Mm-hmm.
Right now in the United States, it's not good. You look at the Democratic Republican Party, it's a mess. You look at the situation in the administration, it's a mess. Are there indications there's people inside government would like to move on with this and get disclosure out? Yes. Is there huge problems? Yes. So it may be that it's got to come outside of the U.S. The U.N. is possible. Canada is possible. France is possible. Second world nation like Brazil might do it if they get joined by some others, or Mexico, whatever, right? But or a major break in ranks of a high-end person, former president or whatever. But, man, it has got to happen soon. We don't have much more time. And in that context of what we're trying to do, let's take a little thing. Here's a little small thing that is an example of what has to happen. Exopolitics has to continue to be advanced. Why? Because it's about the world post-UFO. It's whatever, wherever it goes, and some of it's good, some of it's bad. The point is, it doesn't entertain the possibility that ETs are here. It is based on the fact that ETs are here. And recently, I got definitions submitted to two dictionaries. One is the brand new Webster's Open Dictionary, and you can find this by going Webster Online Open Dictionary. Google that. They just started this. This is an open dictionary that people can submit their own words to. And I know the reason Webster did this is because it's very difficult to vet new words. It's a very long process in the normal scheme of things. This open dictionary makes it a lot easier for them to see new words and learn about them and maybe make decisions quicker about putting them into the formal Webster dictionary. I'm talking about the formal Webster. This is not some branch operation. There is one other major open dictionary, and it's called Wiktionary, Wiktionary. And guess what? Yeah, it's a sister to Wikipedia.
Yep.
And there is a definition on exopolitics that's submitted there as well. Same one. I invite people to go to Wiktionary and the Webster Open Dictionary and read these definitions. The definition is the one that I have been using for some time. It is basic. It is fundamental. It does not try to embellish, because the more essential and basic the definition is of exopolitics, but still getting the point across, the more likely it will become formalized in the mainstream dictionaries. If you make it a lot of bells and whistles, you got not a definition, but an encyclopedia entry. Won't make it. So this little step, right? So when that word finally makes it into a real Webster dictionary, it's a little step. Fine. We need thousands of those little steps, not consecutively, but concurrently going on all the time. You know, as you know, there's an initiative coming out of Vancouver from Alfred Weber and others that is approaching the Senate. We know that there's an initiative now slowly moving its way toward the UN. As soon as I get some operational money, which hopefully I'm going to be getting next week, I'm going to start cranking up again, and I'm going to be bringing those initiatives and targeting the Congress along those lines to start the ball rolling again and begin the process of raising awareness prior to going into these elections, which, if we don't do anything, every single person running for Congress, all 435 seats, which is about 1,000 candidates, will go through the entire campaign in 2006 and never mention or utter or reflect on the ET issue one second unless we force them to.
Who would you like to see make the announcement, Stephen Bessett?
That's a brutal question to ask me with just only a couple minutes left. I demand 40 more minutes.
It's a good cliffhanger, actually, to wind it up on.
I'll give you the short answer. I believe that the United States, after the World War II, represented a very powerful moral, political, and economic base of leadership that we've lost, and we need it back. I believe the United States needs to reassert that leadership by changing its behavior, by altering its foreign policies. I believe that leading the disclosure event, bringing it out, would be the best way for it to get back on track and lead us into this next paradigm. So I still think the United States is the best case, assuming other behavior also changes at the same time, and it's not used to facilitate the same kind of nonsense. The rest of the world will help mitigate that by following suit immediately. But if the U.S. will not move, then it's got to come somewhere else. And I don't care where. It just has to happen.
Yeah, it doesn't matter where it comes from. You're right.
As long as
ultimately, it's got to happen.
Yeah.
If you ask me that question, I'll give you an honest answer. The U.S. needs to do this if they can do it. I think it would help us, too. But Is it essential in the long run? No, it's not absolutely essential. Hmm.
Well, an interesting 40 minutes or so, Stephen Bassett. As usual, always interesting, whether we see eye to eye on everything or not. I want to thank you again, sir. Enjoy the California weather, and we will talk to you in about 4 weeks.
My best to all of you, Victor. Keep up the good work.
And will do.
We'll talk in a month and see where we're at.
One step at a time.
Yeah.
Good night, Stephen.
Good night.
Good night. Stuart Miller, who is a regular contributor to this program, a British correspondent, and the supplier of the many of the news items, the UFO space-related news items that that get posted every day to the UFO updates list, posted an interesting today, and I just want to take a few moments and read you some of it. The world of ufology is filled with courageous people who've been prepared to push the authorities to the limits of their patience in their search and quest for the truth. People who won't take no for an answer, they feel they're entitled to be told what their government knows about unidentified flying objects, regardless of the consequences for themselves. And if the government won't tell them, then they'll go find out for themselves. Troublemakers in simple terms, and troublemaking can come at a personal price. Those of you who have been interested in the Gary McKinnon case, the British youngster who broke into the National Security Agency's computers and various other U.S. governmental organizations in his quest for UFO information. He was in an extradition hearing this week, actually, in the United Kingdom. The Americans want him. They want to treat him like a terrorist and lock him up for a lifetime. At least that's the concern of the authorities in Britain, and so they have adjourned the hearing, his extradition hearing, until they get assurances from the United States government that they won't mistreat him. Oh, yeah, sure, send him over. We won't mistreat him. Yeah.
We'll put him with all the other people that we're mistreating, but we won't mistreat him.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you see, the thing is that if you push too hard, they push back. And they watch and they wait, and they're bigger than you. These are the words now of Stuart Miller. Yes, there is a long and rich history of surveillance of ufologists, but surprisingly, not because they're interested in UFOs, but because either they might be using the subject of ufology as a cover for other less patriotic activities, or because in the course of their snooping, they might just come across things that they shouldn't. Like the concept of non-terrestrial officers, for example, or in Paul Benowitz's case, NSA secret communication satellite testing. And we talked about Paul Benowitz a few months ago with Greg Bishop, who wrote the book on Paul Benowitz. And for the first time, a new book on the subject uncovers the truth and the stories behind this snooping by the authorities. A name you'll recognize, Nick Redfern, whose own activities were closely monitored by Special Branch in Britain for a number of years, lifts the lid on what went on and why. And in particular, for the delight of British ufologists, Nick finally reveals the truth about APEN, APEN, the mysterious organization that plagued British ufology for close to 20 years and caused infighting and disruption to the UK Ufological Committee. Nick's book, Saucer Spies, will be released at the beginning of March by Anomalous Books, and UFO Review, which is Stuart Miller's e-zine publication, will be carrying a detailed and inevitably long interview with Nick about the book. And
if you thought Body Snatchers turned the world upside down, then be prepared to really get into a spin with this one, I think.
Yeah, I think that's the way it's going to go.
It really shows how extremely political all of this can really get. And as soon as somebody starts snooping in a way that isn't in accordance with the regular kinds of seeking of information, you can look for information through the government as long as you follow the correct channels. As soon as you go outside of those channels or start seeking information that's a little beyond the channels, you start to get pressure. And I think that's where the politicization of this whole issue really comes in. That's part of it that really fascinates me. And I don't know, we can put pressure on political authorities. Unfortunately, people who are sitting in the elected seats of Parliament and Congress, unfortunately, know very, very little about all this information.
Mm-hmm.
You have to go into the back rooms to get to the people that can press the buttons that release the information.
The clandestine organizations that suck up all that black budget money.
That's right. Mm-hmm. And the organizations that we don't know the alphabets to.
Yes. Yeah, the acronyms.
Yeah.
And we'll try and get a hold of Nick Redfern and bring him on the program, and we can talk about the put-throughs that he got from that British APEN organization.
Mm-hmm.
An interesting anniversary coming up this coming Wednesday.
1942.
Yeah, 62 years ago, February the 25th. The event was known as the Battle of Los Angeles, a remarkable UFO encounter that happened that night over Los Angeles. It was really astounding what went on. Of course, Second World War, the Americans were really concerned that somebody would come over and drop bombs. And this object, a saucer-shaped object, appeared in the skies over Los Angeles. And, of course, there were all kinds of anti-aircraft batteries in and around that area. Big city on the West Coast, the Japanese, Fugo balloons. Yeah, there was just a lot of panicky people, was what it was. But searchlights triangulated on this disc-shaped object, and the anti-aircraft guns fired nearly 2,000 rounds at this thing, many of which seemed to bounce off it. 2,000 rounds of 12-pound high-explosive shells.
With searchlights being right on it.
Yeah, I mean, this thing was locked into the searchlight beams. At least, what, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, probably 9 or 10 searchlights, all locked in on it, and all these anti-aircraft guns pounding the hell out of it. And what happened? It flew away. But the newscast from that event is interesting. And Wendy Connors of Faded Discs, a couple of three times ago when she was on, played us this news report.
Anti-aircraft guns went into action against unidentified aircraft in the Los Angeles area shortly after 3 a.m. Pacific wartime this morning. The anti-aircraft guns began barking during a blackout ordered by the 4th Interceptor Command at 2:25 a.m. The unidentified object, which some sources thought might be a blimp, moved slowly down the Pacific coast from Santa Monica and disappeared south of Long Beach. Army officials declined to comment on the possibility that the object might have been a blimp. However, it required nearly 30 minutes to travel some 25 miles, far slower than an airplane. Watchers on the rooftop of the Columbia Broadcasting Building in the heart of Hollywood could plainly see the flashes of guns and searchlights sweeping the skies in a wide arc along the coastal area. Concussion of the shells could be felt in downtown Los Angeles, 15 miles away. U.S. Army planes quickly took to the dark skies, but whether they contacted the object has not been announced. Army officials say they will not comment until they receive a full report of the action. Although some watchers say they saw airplanes in the air, semi-official sources say they probably were the U.S. Army's pursuit. Several observers say they saw one or more planes spotlighted by 20 or 30 searchlights. The object moved southward, presumably over Huntington Park at the western edge of Los Angeles, and on southward to about Long Beach on the coast. By 3:30 a.m., observers said the object appeared to be over the south of Long Beach. Searchlights closely followed the object down the coast and kept it centered in their glare. Shells frequently could be seen bursting near the object, but none appeared to hit it. The shooting stopped about 3:30 a.m. The shooting brought warfare to the front door of this city of 1.25 million population for the first time since December 7th. Already, it was alert to the presence off the Southern California coast of a Japanese submarine which had pumped 25 shells into an oil field north of Santa Barbara Monday evening. Because of the presence of the submarine, a three-hour alert was ordered at dusk last night, and civilian authorities stood at their posts while the Army and Navy continued their search for the submersible. The evening alert ended at 10:23 p.m., but another was sounded at 2:22 a.m., and the blackout followed within 3 minutes. It covered Los Angeles County from Santa Monica to Pomona. At 2:27, all Southern California radio stations were ordered off the air, except those in San Diego. Approximately 20 minutes after the firing died down, the ship returned and headed westward from Long Beach toward Santa Monica. The guns went into action again, hurling round after round of shells at the object. The second barrage appeared to be closer to downtown Los Angeles, since watchers could hear the concussion of the guns more clearly and the flash of bursting shells was brighter. Then the ship disappeared for the second time over the ocean. We return you now to CBS in New York.
And to News Talk 1010 CFRB in Toronto and CJAD 800 in Montreal. The ship, the man kept saying. The ship. Not the aircraft, not the blimp, but the ship.
The ship.
Now, whether, you know, they meant airship or spaceship or... It wasn't the Queen Mary, that's for sure. She didn't make it to California until many years later. But an interesting newscast. And 2,000 rounds of 12-pound high-explosive shells firing into the air. And, of course, there were casualties, not in the air, but on the ground. You fire a shell upward, and sooner or later it has to come down. 6 people died. And they never found out what it was. Or did they? And it was just never reported. This coming Wednesday, February the 25th, 1942, the Battle of Los Angeles.
I keep on thinking if that happened today. Some night, some quiet night over coast of Newfoundland, wherever.
Shag Harbor.
Shag Harbor, yeah. Lights beaming on something. And
mm-hmm. RCMP watching. From a boat.
Sure. Jet scrambled.
Watch a disc fly into the water and yellow foam, sulfur smell.
Mm-hmm.
How many times have we heard that from abductees and various other UFO witnesses? The smell of sulfur.
Yeah. Pungent.
Nothing
smell
to do with the Battle of Los Angeles, but we went there anyway.
Yeah.
Last week, for the benefit of those of you who missed it, we played several clips recorded by Michel Deschamps, the Sudbury Section Director for the Mutual UFO Network of Ontario. He interviewed a man named Don Campbell, a foreman at the INCO. But Don is one of the finest welders on the planet, a specialist. Had a deep and abiding interest in UFOs. We played several of his encounters last week. One that we didn't get to, that we wanted to get to tonight in the brief time that we have left. This is Don Campbell talking about an event that happened, I think, in 1968.
This is the night that Jimmy Tomasini and myself, we were heading out, and I guess it was about 1:15, and we got parked down at the far end of Maley Drive, and we were ready for our little excursion into the bush. Got the telescope over our shoulder and the legs and the weights, binoculars around our neck, and we seen two little stars in the sky quite high. And we looked again and said, geez, those aren't stars. And they were both coming down side by side. We don't know how far apart they were until I'd say they were maybe 4 or 5 miles high, and we realized what we were looking at was two nice little white objects, which we believe had to be UFOs. So we weren't going to aim the telescope up at that moment. Too awkward, you know, your sighting scope and everything. Binoculars up, both focusing. We said, by geez, we've got visitors. We're in luck tonight. And no sooner said than done, the one on the right-hand side, down, from a white star, and he turned on his blinking red light. Now, why they turn on the red light as they get lower? It's just like a warning to other craft, you know, we're here. don't bump into us. Up to that time, it was just the white star, just like a star, and his red blinking light, pumps like an aircraft would. He come down. First thing we know is Jimmy says, "Jesus, you're right over the line." And the red light out, and then it took on a beautiful white glow, a natural, just like a halo, and traveling very, very slowly down the line, just very, very, very slowly. And Jimmy says, "Uh-oh." He said, "It's got to be sucking up power, because from this hill view, we could look over at any remaining street lights, lights in people's windows, anything. We could look over toward New Sudbury in general." And we said, "Look at this. Street lights, they didn't go out. They dimmed. House lights, dim. And we watched this. We're looking at the lights. We're looking at the UFO. And it's going down the line. And it seemed to stop and then come back up toward us. It wasn't going away any longer. As far as we're concerned, it had stopped and reversed itself and was coming back up. It was definitely a round object. You could see the actual shape of the craft glowing over the wire. And 20, 25 minutes, maybe a half hour passed. I don't know exactly, although I did write it in my little notepad how long it was. And then when it seemed to be fully satisfied with the power, the other one was sitting parked up there, like I said, about 5 miles high, still remaining white. And it went up, parked beside it, maybe 300, maybe 500 feet. Hard to judge distance when two things are. And it went up to about the same elevation, and the other one came down where it left off. And I guess it was charging up its system, and it did the same thing. But the exciting thing about the second one was, as it went down the line, all the lights went right out. All the lights in New Sudbury went out, all the street lights went out. This one was apparently drawing a heavier load. That's what excited me more than anything else, was the lights didn't dim. They just dimmed right till it just sucked all the power right out. We watched this for almost the same length of time, and it went up to join this other one. Both turned on their pulsating red lights, and then up, 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 and then the red lights off, and then two little stars in the sky, and they were gone. We jump in the car, we drive down at the hydro exchange on the Garrison Road. There's a little buzzer you can ring for gate entry. The guy that was on duty that night was my namesake. He was another Don Campbell, same age as me, 3 months difference in our birthday, and he was Don Campbell. And he was the same name as me. And we said, I've been watching UFOs for quite a while out here. And he says, I got quite scared the other night. And he said, I got scared again tonight. He says, that one almost came up to my back door when we told him that we were watching a UFO. He says, yes. He says, this isn't the first time. We're supposed to keep our mouth shut about it. He says, pretty scary. He says, when you have one come up. And he said, you're looking at your gauges and you're dropping from 100,000 to 30,000. You're just losing all your power. And then you go up the back, and he said, and you look up the line, and here's this glowing object coming down. And he said, this was the second time this week that we got visitors. He says, so close that it frightened me, and he said, I went back in and closed the door. I didn't want to look at it. He says, then he said, when my power came back up to 100,000, he said, well, the bugger's gone. He said, no sooner said than done. He says, down goes my power, 100,000, 70,000, 50,000, 30,000, and dropping. He said, I didn't have 1,000 volts left in the line. That's when all of it, what we'd witnessed. We said, that's when we seen all the lights go out. He said, oh yeah, 15 minutes at least, he says, we lost total power. He said, it's all on the graph paper, you know, the reading. He said, that thing was just sucking everything that was coming through that line. He said, this line feeds big majority of New Sudbury, you know, different parts of Sudbury, downtown and everything. He says, he'd have to look at his map to see, you know, what the junction, where that thing, that particular line. So he said, I come back out, and sure enough, he says, and another UFO. He says, oh boy. He says, of course, our list is written down in my report, and I report to the hydro inspectors, and also to Hennessy, who was the head Ontario man. I phoned in my report from a phone booth later, into my 969 number, told them what I had witnessed, told them who I talked to, told them the whole story, and I guess they maybe were taking me at the other end, because every time I phoned, they were supposed to get, so they can pass it on to the day shift. Told them about it. They said, well, we've seen the UFOs parked. We've seen one disappear out of the sky. It's below our radar line. And then we've seen it come back up, like you said, at that time. And we've seen the other one disappear. And then it was below our radar line. And then the two together, yes, that all coincides with exactly what you were saying. And then they both left together. And again, 15, 20,000 miles an hour as they sped away, all charged up. So they seem to depend on our hydro line power for charging up these smaller, they're little 30, 40, 50 foot craft, which is, to me, is highly interesting, because if they're from outer space, another planet, and they got a mothership that's, say, 1,000 miles high, or they don't go back to their mothership to take power, all kinds of hydro juice down here, they just draw it, actually visibly touching, or they're just so close, but the craft glows. It actually gets a halo and a glow. It's amazing. It really is amazing. To see this, you no longer have any doubt in your mind. You are watching somebody from another world that may be 20, 30,000 years ahead of us in science. You know, it's absolutely amazing.
It certainly is. And for our international listeners, and I know a lot of you out there are scratching your heads, what does it mean, hydro? Hydroelectric power. Where traditionally in Ontario, the juice came from Niagara Falls, and the water powered the turbines which created the electricity, hence the name hydroelectric. And in Ontario, we don't call it electricity, we call it the hydro.
The hydro, yes.
So there, that's what Don Campbell up in Sudbury experienced, UFOs sucking energy out of the power grid and eventually darkening the whole of New Sudbury down to black.
It brings to mind the question, when does anecdotal information become prima facie evidence?
Yeah. Well,
you know,
anecdotal evidence has been known to hang people.
Yeah.
It's been enough. But it just ain't enough in this situation.
No.
No, because they don't exist. These people are all crazies, seeing all kinds of crazy things and saying all kinds of crazy things. They're all saucerheads. They're weirdos. They're not to be trusted. But we'll come back and do program 381 about the untrusted next week. Victor, thank you.
You're welcome.
We will talk to you next Saturday night. We'll talk some strangeness with Lauren Coleman, cryptozoologist, for a little while tomorrow, next Saturday, and maybe even Robert Hastings about UFOs and nuclear missiles. Good night.
That's this week's edition of Strange Days Indeed, hosted and produced by Errol Bruce Knapp. The executive producer is Gene Mastodon.